Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. I'm Guy McPherson. I'm going solo tonight. This edition of Nature Bats Last, like future episodes, is pre-recorded. As a result, there's no chance to take your questions on the air. Our theme song is provided as a gift with our thanks by Afrozen. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud. Background music for a couple of our regular segments, including the next one, is provided by Scottish teenager Rhiann Farrigan. Tonight's first segment highlights news beyond the echo chamber of the mainstream. I'll mention two stories. A story at Bloomberg from last Thursday is titled FBI Says Surveillance Tabs Should Be Added to Devices. Written by Tom Schoenberg and Chris Strom, the piece comes right out and explains why the Federal Bureau of Investigation must be allowed to spy on U.S. citizens. FBI Director James Comey is quoted, "We are struggling to keep up with changing technology and maintain our ability to actually collect communications we are authorized to collect." Dr. Paul Craig Roberts was Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy and Associate Editor of the Wall Street Journal. As he pointed out last week on his website, quoting former CIA Director William Colby, "The CIA owns every one of any significance in the major media. And yet the surveillance state wants more." There you have it, fellow Americans. The federal government is no longer trying to hide its spying and is now claiming it is authorized to do so. Those of us paying attention to them have known that since at least the year 2000, each of our keystrokes in every Microsoft product goes directly to the National Security Agency. But until recently, the government has lied when asked about its illegal actions. Well, what will it take to elicit a response to the police state from the citizenry? As George Orwell pointed out, he who controls the past controls the future. He who controls the present controls the past. Not only is the federal government using every attempt to seize the present, but it is also rewriting the past. Consider my second story beyond the echo chamber. Writing at LibertyBlitzkrieg.com last Thursday in a story headlined Propaganda 101, How the Pentagon is Trying to Rewrite Vietnam War History, Michael Krieger describes how the federal government is rolling out a 50th anniversary commemoration of the Vietnam War. Bear in mind that many of the more than a million lives lost in that police action resulted directly from well-documented acts of deception by the U.S. government, such as the Gulf of Tonkin incident. I'll quote Krieger. "What's worse, the Pentagon intends to rewrite history by whitewashing this period of civil unrest and government shame from American history. The propaganda is so blatant that it has resulted in many of the era's most well-known protesters and activists to come together in order to stop it." The article goes on to quote extensively from the New York Times as it describes a war of valor and honor that would be unrecognizable to many of the Americans who fought in and against it. Leading Vietnam historians complain that it focuses on dozens of medal-winning soldiers while giving scant attention to mistakes by generals and the years of violent protests and anguished debate at home. Again, this from the New York Times. The glossy view of history has now prompted more than 500 scholars, veterans, and activists, including the civil rights leader Julian Bond, Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the top secret Pentagon papers, Lawrence J. Korb, a former Assistant Secretary of Defense under President Ronald Reagan, and Peter Yarrow of the folk trio Peter, Paul, and Mary, to join Mr. Hayden in demanding the ability to correct the Pentagon's version of history and a place for the old anti-war activists in the anniversary events. Mr. Hayden, 74, and other 1960s-era activists who helped him gather signatures say they do not quarrel with honoring the sacrifice of soldiers, but they object to having the military write the story. All of us remember that the Pentagon got us into this war in Vietnam with its version of the truth, Mr. Hayden said in a recent telephone interview from Berkeley, California, where he had attended a rally to mark another 50th anniversary, that of the free speech movement. If you conduct a war, you shouldn't be in charge of narrating it. Personally, I'm offended by the term war when it comes to U.S. military actions, nearly all of which, since World War II, are best termed conquest, not war. But that's a minor quibble relative to the ongoing absurdities of a police state headed the wrong direction, and a citizenry unwilling to face the facts, much less act on them. This week I interview Ray McGovern, a legend in the whistleblower community. Ray leads the Speaking Truth to Power section of Tell the Word, an expression of the Ecumenical Church of the Savior in inner-city Washington. A co-director of the Servant Leadership School between 1998 and 2004, he has been teaching there for 15 years. Ray came from his native New York to Washington in the early 1960s as an Army infantry-slash-intelligence officer, and then served as a CIA analyst from the administration of John F. Kennedy to that of George H.W. Bush. Ray's duties include sharing national intelligence estimates and preparing the president's daily brief, which he briefed one-to-one to President Ronald Reagan and his most senior national security advisors from 1981 to 1985. So with that brief intro, Ray McGovern, if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and tell us what you've been working on lately, that would be a great way to start.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on here. I majored in Russian undergraduate. That was way back in the medieval ages. Actually, it was just the 60s, the early 60s. And the Soviet Union was at that time a real threat. So after I did my 2 years as an Army officer, it was a natural progression to go to the CIA, which had relatively recently been set up for two reasons. The main reason, and the one that President Truman had in mind, was to be an analysis unit that he could go to and be a central place. Okay, that was number one, central. Why central? Well, because before Pearl Harbor, there were all little bits and pieces of information around available to the Navy or to the Army Air Corps or to the code breakers or the FBI, Embassy Tokyo, and so forth and so on. If there were one central place, one inbox, in those days we had wooden inboxes, believe it or not, if there were one inbox into which all those indicators came, it would have been a no-brainer. Now, Truman knew that. That's why he wanted to create one agency that was pretty much over all the other intelligence agencies and would be, by his fiat, responsible and accountable for giving us, the CIA, all the information we needed from their own sources. The second chief objective was to have a place that was not dominated by the Pentagon. The Pentagon always suggesting to the president that the Russians were 10 feet tall, nor under the State Department, which traditionally would be defending its own policies, but a unit answerable directly to the president. So that's how the CIA was set up. That's what Truman intended. That's what the legislation said in 46 and 47 after the war. And then what happened? Well, the regime changers, the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, which had been the real spies in World War II, and to their great credit, you know, had jumped in behind enemy lines, had overthrown governments, had brought Ho Chi Minh on their shoulders, literally, into Hanoi after the Japanese were thrown out. These people came home from the war, and they had great applause, of course. And then they asked, well, you want us to hang around, or should we go back to our law offices, or universities, or our corporations? And the Russians had already taken over Eastern Europe. The KGB was running all around the world. And so the question answered itself, of course we need you. And then the problem became, where are we going to put these people? Where are we going to put these people that overthrow governments and know the black arts? Well, some airhead, and that's about as charitable a word as I can think of, some airhead thought, well, since part of the CIA that Truman wants, the analysis group, is going to be secret, because they will have to depend on some of the information that their own spies collect. Well, let's put the spies and the covert action types, the overthrowers of government. We don't say that anymore. We say regime change. The regime changers, let's put them all in this one happy agency called the CIA. And at the last minute, one sentence was added onto the legislation, which said the director of Central Intelligence shall perform such other functions and duties related to intelligence as the president shall from time to time direct. Now, bear in mind that if you have an unscrupulous president and an unscrupulous director of Central Intelligence, a toady, as you did under George W. Bush and George Tenet, you have the makings of a president having his own personal Gestapo, and do not blanch before that word. I'll just give a little substance to that. Many have heard of these enhanced interrogation techniques. Guess what? Where does that phrase come from? It comes from the Gestapo handbook. The word in German is Verschärfte Vernehmung, sharpened interrogation or enhanced interrogation. And guess what? The methods that were adduced that are codified in the Gestapo handbook are most of the methods that were approved later when the war started, or actually when the attack on Afghanistan started. So this is kind of a thing that most people don't know. I thought it'd be good to clarify it from the beginning, because there are basically two CIAs, the ones that do regime change, and I'm sad to say, let themselves be suborned into kidnapping, torture, running black prisoners around the world. There's that CIA, and then there's the one that Truman intended, and that was the one I worked in for 27 years. The first CIA, the operations thing, was something that Truman specifically condemned before he died, saying in an op-ed in the Washington Post, "I never intended that the CIA become this kind of operational outfit. What I wanted was somebody to serve up intelligence to me, pure and simple, without any agenda, without fear or favor, and one that was possessed of all the necessary information to come to cogent judgments on what was going on in the world." I was proud to serve in that. Indeed, I had career protection for serving and telling the truth to presidents, and I knocked a lot of four-star generals' noses out of joint in the process. And when they complained bitterly about this guy McGovern, my superiors, most of them at least, said, no, we think he's right, and they protected me. So that's something that not many people know, and I think it will influence the way this conversation goes. I just wanted to make clear that that's the CIA I worked in. The other one I knew about from the newspapers. We were hermetically sealed off from the operations department. You had to go through a turnstile with a special key to get on that side of the building. That's how bad it was. So, just to set the stage, that was my discipline. That was my job. And when I saw my own job, our own discipline of telling the president the truth without fear or favor, when I saw that too had been, what's the word? Corrupted is not strong. It had been prostituted. That George Tenet, the head of the CIA under George Bush, when George Bush said, "Look, George, I want to make a war against Iraq, and I need you to gin up some evidence, some intelligence that will justify me going to Congress and getting permission." And so George Tenet, to his great discredit, saluted, and not only were the torturers and the kidnappers given free rein, but my former comrades on the analytical side, there are enough people there to do George Tenet's bidding, and you know the rest of the story. A lot of fairy tales told. In the end, when the Senate completed its investigation of 5 years into how good the pre-war, pre-Iraq war intelligence was, they concluded, and I quote their chairman, that intelligence was, quote, unsubstantiated, comma, contradicted, comma, or even non-existent, period, end quote. I ask you, what does non-existent intelligence look like? And I tell you, forgery and other things it used to show that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and that he was likely to give them to terrorists. It was a very bad performance. I should really add this, though, that after that debacle, where both sides of the CIA or both CIAs were guilty of malfeasance, somebody got it into their head to have an honest person come in and run the next national intelligence estimate on Iran. That person's name was Tom Finger. They got him from the State Department. He brought in some of the specialists from the State Department that had not been tainted by the pre-war intelligence on Iraq. And they issued in 2007 an honest estimate on Iranian intentions and capabilities in the nuclear sphere. And that conclusion was what George Bush later called eye-popping, because it said unanimously, with 16 U.S. intelligence agencies buying into this and saying with high confidence, Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon in the fall of 2003, okay, 4 years previous, and had not resumed work on that weapon. Now, why do I mention that? Because that was CIA at its best. That's what the intelligence is supposed to do. And although I've been around 51 years in Washington, I could never say before that a national intelligence estimate, an honest one, played a huge role, probably the most important role, in preventing a major war, the war that Bush and Cheney intended to make against Iran in the last year of their tenure, 2008. Indeed, in Bush's own memoir, he says, this was an eye-popping estimate because it deprived me of the military option. And this last quote, I couldn't believe that he actually wrote this, but apparently he wrote this section himself. He said, quote, for how was I to authorize an attack on the nuclear facilities of a country that the entire intelligence community unanimously said with high confidence had no active nuclear weapons program, end quote. Well, bummer. God, you would think, you know, if he was really surprised at that, he would have called the Israelis and said, hey, guess what? Guess what we learned? Wow. Right. So you can see what the game was. And this is out of the mouth, out of the horse's, well, I'll just say politely, out of the horse's mouth.
Right. And speaking of horses, it seems like the horse got out of the barn a long time ago with respect to the shadowy side of the CIA. And that there's no turning back. I don't see a lot of change in the right direction by the current administration. What about you?
Well, you know, I have kind of a longer view of history. I'm a little bit older than you, Guy. I've seen it go bad, and then I've seen it get better again. And the last example I had used, where they did do an honest estimate, which was really very consequential, that's a reminder that these things can change and they can change very quickly. Now, I don't hold much hope for this particular president because I cannot escape the conclusion that he's afraid of the CIA, that he's afraid of the military, that he's afraid of NSA and FBI. And, you know, one would sympathize with that, but I don't think he should have chosen to become president or even run for president if that's the way he was going to act. So I don't see him coming out in any real sense to reform things because he's afraid. He's personally afraid, and he's also afraid of what happened to John Kennedy back in 1963 when he crossed these powers in establishment Washington. They still exist, and you could see the results of their power almost every day.
Well, sure. 2 days ago, in the October 19th issue of the Boston Globe, an article was headlined, "Vote All You Want, the Secret Government Won't Change." In a rare departure from the mainstream media's focus on distraction and irrelevance, the article described the President of the United States as an empty suit who does the bidding of the secret government. Can you elaborate on that idea and put that within the context of what we've talked about so far?
Yeah, I guess when I hear the word empty suit, you know, I look not only at Obama, but I look at John Kerry, who's even a little inch or two higher than, taller than Obama. And there's an empty suit if I ever saw one. You know, pastel ties don't make a man. And when I look at Obama and the coterie of people around him, I consider that, number one, they have no real experience in world affairs. They're all political hacks. Number two, they don't know anything about the Middle East. And number three, they're afraid of the operators, the people who could do them in if they so felt. Now, that seems like a big exaggeration, but why else? Why else would Obama come into office, having really excoriated the practice of torture and that kind of thing, and then say, you know, we're not going to look backwards here. We're just going to look forward and leave the torturers in place. There's still a bunch of them there at CIA headquarters. Imagine an analyst going down to lunch, right? And his buddy says, hey, well, there's Joe Hernandez. He was the guy, main torturer in Bagram Air Force Base. And now there's another guy. I mean, hello. That's how bad it is. So Obama did not do what we all kind of hoped and expected he would, clean house. Indeed, he left people in key positions. The only person that he didn't reappoint, so to speak, was the totally corrupt General Michael Hayden, who corrupted not only NSA during his long tenure there, but also went along with everything that went on at CIA. And for services rendered, he was made head of CIA. And now, guess what? Now he's interpreting everything for us on CNN and Fox News. He's kind of the go-to guy to explain everything. It would be funny if it weren't so serious, guy.
Yes, I absolutely agree with that. You know, the article in the Boston Globe, and then you point out that, and there seems to be a little tension here. You know, Sibel Edmonds recently pointed out that the CIA and other intelligence organizations were behind the events of September 11th, 2001. And so that sort of indicates how powerless the president is in light of these stunningly powerful forces. First of all, do you concur with Sibel Edmonds' assessment? And are those events emblematic of the intelligence community today? Here we are 13 years later and change. Are they actually more important than the president? Does the president, no matter how much spine he has, really not matter unless he's willing to take the John F. Kennedy route by bucking the powers that be?
Well, on 9/11, guy, I admire Sibel Edmonds very much, and a great deal of her accomplishments have been not appreciated enough. On 9/11, I'd have to say this, that you know, when people ask me, Ray, come on, don't you believe that Dick Cheney is capable of perpetrating an act like 9/11? And I say, of course I do. But I don't do faith-based intelligence, okay? It doesn't matter what I believe. It's what I see in the empirical evidence. Now, Sibel may have evidence that I don't have. Certainly, there's quite enough evidence to suggest that there was some official knowledge of what was going to happen. I think the real indictment comes from the co-chairman of the 9/11 Commission itself, Governor Kaine of New Jersey, and Lee Hamilton, the token Democrat that they trot out every time they need somebody official to be the leading Democrat. they wrote a book a couple of years after the 9/11 Commission report came out. And in that book, they said, we were set up to fail. We weren't given enough money. We weren't given enough time. And we weren't given enough access to sensitive classified information. And so we were set up to fail. Wow. Well, isn't that nice? Would it have been nicer, I think, if they told us at the time, huh? But no, they went along, and they had this beautifully edited little volume, the 9/11 Commission. There are a couple of nuggets in there that are very interesting and useful, but the whole thing was a cover-up. So the question is, what's being covered up? Now, when you look at all the things that went wrong, let's take those two hijackers in San Diego, for example, Guy. We know a lot of things about them. Some people don't know everything that I know because I've talked to the NSA people. First off, we know that the CIA knew that these folks were there. And some 50 people in the CIA knew that they were there. And guess what? The CIA never told anyone. Never told even the counterterrorism czar, Richard Clark. Now, why is that? Well, two or three years ago, Richard Clark permitted himself to speculate about that. He was on a public radio program in Denver, and they asked him these questions, and he said, look, there were 50 people in CIA who knew about the existence of these two terrorists in San Diego, but they kept that information from me. And the question was, well, who would have had to authorize that? And Clark said that would have had to have been the director, George Tenet, whom I mentioned before. So why would they have done that? Well, Clark says, the only reason I can figure out is that the CIA was so embarrassed not to have not one source in Al-Qaeda, that here were two live bodies, in country, in San Diego. If we could only turn them, that's a word for, you know, doubling them. Okay, if we only turn them and let them work for us, man, that wouldn't. Oh, we'd go to White House and say, we got two now, right? And to do that, George Tenet of the CIA would have had to obscure the fact, hide the fact from the FBI. That they were in our country. Why? Because then the FBI has jurisdiction. Then the CIA is out of the ballgame, and guess what? The FBI gets credit for doubling these guys, if they're doubled before they, of course, crash their plane into the Pentagon. So that was really bad, you know? Could Tenet have been so parochial, so insular, and so self-absorbed that he and the agency would keep that information from people who could do something about it in country? Well, the answer is yes. And if you look at all the other things that Tenet did, you're convinced that. Now, okay, what about the NSA? Well, I'll say this more briefly. The NSA not only knew these two people were in San Diego, they knew who they were, they knew the Al-Qaeda Central, a switchboard and safe house in Yemen with whom they were communicating. And when our president of the United States says, oh, if we only had the number of those folks in San Diego, guess what? We had the number. We had the number because it's as easy as caller ID to get the number once you've got these conversations. And guess what? We didn't just have the metadata, we had the content of at least seven conversations. And so Thomas Drake, who joined NSA as a high-level executive right after 9/11, they thought he was like all the rest of them out there, and so they gave him the job to look at the pre-war intelligence, what was available to NSA that might have tipped off the fact that there were going to be these strikes, these terrorist strikes. And Tom Drake is a straight guy. He uncovered the fact that they had all this information, and not only that, they had done a substantive memorandum which tied all the nodes of Al-Qaeda together. They just didn't share it with the rest of Washington. In Tom's view, because once you have that kind of information, you have great power, and probably the NSA didn't take very seriously what Al-Qaeda might be able to do. So what I'm saying here is you had the CIA and the NSA both knowing about these terrorists in San Diego, neither of whom told the FBI, Homeland Security, anybody else. And so there's enough material there for anyone to construct a scenario which would say, wait a second, you know, this sounds really bad. And when you look at what the FBI uncovered in Minnesota, namely Moussaoui, he's the famous fellow who was really interested in learning how to steer one of these jumbo jets, but not so interested in learning how to take off or how to land, okay? Hello, little tip there, maybe? Well, the people in Minneapolis and the FBI were tearing their hair out. They got him on a, you know, immigration charge, and they wanted to look into his laptop, and they couldn't get permission from their elders or their supervisors at FBI headquarters in Washington. So when you put all that stuff together, it's very easy to conclude that there was some real, real conspiracy here. The only problem is that unless you have worked in government for 25, 30 years, as I have and as Colleen Rowley has — Colleen Rowley was the FBI lawyer and the special agent who pleaded the cause from Minnesota and then actually divulged how badly the FBI had screwed up right after 9/11. She and I both remind people all the time that you have no idea. You have no idea how the U.S. government can screw up. They can screw up royally. And so with respect to the question of what's being covered up, Colleen and I are of one mind in reminding people that it's equally possible that it's just these screw-ups that are being covered up as it is some broader conspiracy. The last thing
it could very well be that the issue is more about incompetence than anything else, and wanting to cover up that incompetence so that people don't have a jaded view or a cynical view about the government.
Yeah, or people lose their jobs, or people get fired, but be held accountable. You know, that's not supposed to happen, I guess, what these people feel. The other thing I'll say is that two things. One is that I really get angry when people criticize others for being, quote, conspiracy theorists, end quote. Well, these are people just trying to find honest answers to these glaring questions. The architects and engineers are a group that I admire greatly. I've emceed a couple of their meetings in the past. You know, why did Building 7 fall? Well, it was a controlled demolition, that's clear. But what does that have to do with the rest of the scenario? I don't know. Last thing is this, that when you have a conspiracy that would have had, if you had a government kind of conspiracy that would have had to involve scores of people, almost always after another decade or, you know, 12 years, you get one of the involved sounding off to his girlfriend in the bar saying, I'll tell you how, you want to know how 9/11 went down? This is the way it went down. And it comes out. Nothing like that has happened. There have been things close to that, but nothing very, very definitive. So that's another reason why Colleen and I kind of say, look, what we need is an independent investigation. That's clear, since the chairman of the 9/11 Commission have admitted that theirs was a feckless exercise. And the sooner that happens, the better. The political atmosphere is militates against that, but so what? My friends in New York, and I am a native New Yorker, are trying their darndest to get this independent investigation going. And who knows? Maybe this will happen.
This is Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Guy McPherson, and I'm joined by renowned whistleblower Ray McGovern. Let's take a step back, maybe two steps, Ray. Most Americans of your age and stature would be content to retire in relative peace. They would travel, read, watch television. But it seems you're unwilling to take a break from the relatively thankless and difficult work that you're involved in. So why do you do this? Why do you continue to play the fly in the ointment and try to get at the root of any number of issues?
Well, there are a couple of reasons, Guy. One is my intense disappointment that the Bush-Cheney administration was able to corrupt my former colleagues in the CIA that Truman intended, namely the analysis group. I would like the doctors to be equally upset. I would like the psychologists to be equally upset. And above all, I would like the lawyers to be equally upset because they were all prostituted and their professions dragged through the mud. And if I sound a little angry, well, Thomas Aquinas said anger is a virtue. And so I feel very virtuous, okay? But, you know, when you look at it, it wasn't just the intelligence analysis profession. It was all these people. And what does the American Bar Association say about that? Or thank God there are a group of sincere and ethical psychologists who are raising hell now because it is proven beyond a shadow of a doubt how the American psychological agency let itself be prostituted by the Pentagon. Read James Risen's book and weep. So, long story short, we used to tell the truth, okay? We used to have career protection for telling the truth. I am encouraged by the fact that my former colleagues measured up and did the right thing with respect to the estimate on Iran, which said that Iran was not working on a nuclear weapon. And so I hope for the future. But there's not going to be any hope unless people like me, who worked in the original ethos of the analysis group, which was, you speak it straight. There was a biblical verse chiseled into the marble wall when I walked into the agency under John Kennedy, and it said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." And I looked at that thing, and all I could think of was my Irish grandmother. If she said once, she said 100 times. She said, "Now, Raymond, be truthful and honest, and then you won't give a damn what anyone says about you." So I'm thinking, hey, Grandma, if that's true, no pun intended, if that inscription or that chiseling on that wall is true, this is going to be a great place to work. And it was. Toward the late 80s, when Bill Casey and Bobby Gates worked their will on the analysts, well, they prepared what happened for what happened a generation later. So when George Tenet came back in 2002, came back from the White House and said now, and gathered his managers around the conference table there in his executive office, and said, "Now we're going to have to do a national intelligence estimate on Iraq." And they had been ducking it, of course, because an honest estimate would have said there's no good evidence that Iraq is working on a nuclear weapon or that they have chemical or biological weapons. But an honest estimate was clearly not wanted. So Tenet tells these people who now, 20 years after Bush, after Bill Casey and Bobby Gates started corrupting the agency leadership, these people all said, "Well, what do we need to do?" And Tenet said, "Well, Dick Cheney just spoke a couple of weeks ago there at the Veterans for Foreign Wars conference, and he said that Iraq had reconstituted its nuclear weapons development program, had all manner of biological, chemical weapons, and not to give any trust to UN inspectors because that just gives you a false sense of security. We've got to say that, and we've got to say it 2 weeks from now, because Cheney wants this to go out before the midterms, so Congress will have to vote whether or not to let all this mushroom cloud stuff and terrorism happen." And to my great regret, my former colleagues, or at least the corrupted managers that Casey and Gates had put in place, takes a generation to corrupt an agency, and they said, "Yes, sir, we'll do it." And so that's what happened after before Iraq, and then, of course, there were the whole series of lies. Now, I think that if you expose those lies, and you then you give due praise to those that worked on the Iranian estimate, then there's a chance that the truth will be promoted. And, you know, the truth be told, Guy, I also have a kind of a moral or a spiritual dimension to all this. The church group that sponsors me, that actually pays me a small salary, can you believe that? They think that this is what church should be doing. And when the pastor, since deceased, asked me to do this full time and stop being a co-director of the Servant Leadership School, I said, well, I'd really like to do that, but I'd need some kind of, I'd need the stipend that I'm getting for being co-director. Oh, we can get that. He said, but there's one condition, and that is that you identify yourself as working with the Ecumenical Church of the Savior in Washington. And I looked at him and I said, Gordon, I would love to do that, but what's in that for you and the church? You know what he said? He said, look, Ray, we all feel we want to support you because what you're doing is what church should be doing. And number two, when they come for you, Ray, I want it to be such that they'll have to come for all of us. I said to myself, sign me up. Man, what a church.
And they that's awesome.
And, you know, one of his little aphorisms was, retirement? Well, retirement is a secular concept. And the last thing is, you know, and this is important, as I go around talking to groups, particularly in the United States, there's this gloom and doom and what can we do and what can we do and isn't it awful? And it reminds me of what I think is a typically American trait, and that is that we're reluctant to start off on something significant unless there's a reasonable prospect that we're going to be successful, you know? So, you know, who likes to be laughed at? Who wants somebody to say, oh, McGovern, what did you do standing up, turning your back to Hillary Clinton? Didn't you know that they're going to beat you up? What are we going to achieve by doing that? Well, the way I reason on that is that, you know, it's not about success. It's about being faithful. And the good is worth doing because it's good. And, you know, the results are not really within your purview. Who knows? Maybe you're just sowing seeds for people to come along after you. But the important thing is not to let the prospect of success or lack of success hinder you from doing what you know is the right thing to do. That's a hard sell for Americans. And the only real way to get around that is to have these small communities that I advocate, where people know what they need to do and can give mutual support as well as mutual accountability to one another in small groups of six or seven. I think Margaret Mead is right in saying that the only thing that has ever changed anything in this world was a small group of committed people. And I think you can make that plural, small groups of committed people, not worried about success, but worrying about being faithful to our traditions, to our moral values, and to those of us who are believers, to what our ethos comes from whatever tradition. Mine is the Judeo-Christian tradition.
And it, by the way, it sounds a lot like it was inspired by Buddhism, this lack of attachment to an outcome and just pursuing right action. Sounds like it could come from any number of religions and really resonates with me as well, even though I consider myself a pretty militant anti-theist or atheist. Mm-hmm. Now, we just have about a minute or two left. I know you've been pursuing information about Ukraine, a region as rich as the Middle East in fossil energy. Can you briefly give us the latest from your work in Ukraine?
Sure. My work has been sort of a press defense, if you know what that is, in basketball. The reality here in the United States and in most of Europe, where I've spent a good bit of time the last couple of months, is that the mass media, the corporate media have the people malnourished on what the truth is with respect to Ukraine. Now, one example would be, I'm doing an interview with BBC, and I'm in a Moscow hotel, and they start, and they say, now, Mr. McGovern, Secretary of Defense Hagel said yesterday that the Russian land grab in Crimea is an example of their devotion to the notion that they're going to reconstitute the Soviet Union and going to expand and just be aggressors and so forth. What do you think? And I said, well, why do you start at the second inning? And they said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, you started with the incorporation of Crimea into Russia, but, you know, what started this round was the coup d'etat in Kiev, which the U.S. openly, in the person of Victoria Nuland, and the EU sponsored and kicked out the duly elected president of the Ukraine in an unconstitutional coup d'etat or putsch. And, you know, there was no evidence, not one scintilla of evidence, that Putin or any of his associates ever gave a thought to reincorporating Crimea into Russia proper until the coup on the 22nd of February. So why do you start with Crimea? Why don't you start where the battle was joined? And they say, oh, well, what do you mean? I said, well, that's where it all started. It all started when the Ukrainians were given a take-it-or-leave-it sort of thing by the Europeans and the U.S. Join us and eventually be incorporated into NATO, or else you'll be cut loose. And the Russians came in with a better offer, including $15 billion right off the bat. And so Yanukovych, the president at the time, rejected the EU offer, which, when he read the fine print, had all these IMF austerity restrictions and everything else, and he went with the Russians. That's when there was a chance to use the popular unrest in the West, in Kiev, to mount this coup. Now, if further proof were needed, and this was really unique, I've seen a lot of coups, okay? But I never saw a tip-off before the coup, 3 or 4 weeks before the putsch in Kiev that removed the constitutional authorities there. Victoria Nuland, the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, is on the open telephone with the ambassador, our ambassador, the American ambassador in Ukraine, okay? His name is Jeffrey Pyatt. So she says, Jeffrey, I think that Yats is the guy. Yeah, Yats? Let the other guys, you know, let them wait, be in waiting. But Yats is our guy. He's been head of the central bank. He knows, he's willing to do the austerity things that the IMF wants. Yats is the guy, okay? Now, somebody intercepted that, probably the Russians, put it up on YouTube, okay? The end of January, it's on YouTube. And so I'm looking at that, I'm saying, well, poor Yats, you know, if he was in the running, this will destroy his chances. I mean, a decent respect for the opinions of mankind would sort of rule him out, right? Well, when I woke up on the 23rd of February and saw that Yatsenyuk, Yats, had been named the Prime Minister of the Ukraine, and that the U.S. had immediately recognized this putsch government, this unconstitutional overthrow of Yanukovych, I said, wow, you know, talk about chutzpah, talk about, and of course, Victoria Nuland said a few nasty things about the EU at the same time, using an F word that I wouldn't want to say on this program, but the arrogance and the whole thing has to do with Russia looking at what's going on with NATO, seeing NATO more than doubling since exactly 25 years ago when the Berlin Wall fell and when we promised not to do that, and then fearing what will happen if U.S. ships are based in Sevastopol, the main naval base there in Crimea, instead of it belonging to Russia rather than the Ukraine. Putin has been very specific in saying, his speeches never get get really reported on. He said, look, when we decided to reincorporate Crimea into Russia, my motivation was as much the prospect of having missile defense units stationed in the Black Sea ready to vitiate our nuclear deterrent as was anything else. It's a big factor. There's a strategic reality there. The Russians were not going to back down. They were not going to allow for that. And with Putin, he has an almost jocular way of approaching these things sometimes. And he said, you know, I know that the sailors of the U.S. and NATO, they're probably swell fellas. But I'd really hate to have it so that we would have to visit them in their base in Sevastopol. I'd much rather have it the way it is now, where they're happy. They're very free to visit our naval base in Sevastopol. This is big-time stuff. This is strategic. And the Russians are not going to back down on that.
Wow, that's quite a tale. I very much appreciate your perspective and your willingness to speak out on any number of contentious issues. Thank you, Ray McGovern, for spending time with me today on the Progressive Radio Network.
You're most welcome, Guy. Good luck to you.
Thank you, and to you. Each week we seek out a doomer who not only goes beyond the status quo, but also provides insightful and useful information. Our doomer for this week is William Gilson, who posted the following paragraph on Facebook's Near-Term Human Extinction Love group. Homo domesticus, the new species. This is the real reason why we scratch our heads over what to do when civilization collapses, and why we can't all agree on what's practical versus what's desirable. We are mentally and socially ill-equipped to sing kumbaya for more than a little while, and certainly not under the stress of collapse. So if my opinion is true, what's going to happen? Well, I'm a career paramedic, 43 years old, a New Orleans Katrina medic, and my experiences tell me we humans will in some cases rediscover what we used to be 10,000 years ago and longer, and some of us will not. The deaths, the torture, the rapes, the theft, the disease, the loneliness, the starvation, the exhaustion, and most of all, the time will all test Homo domesticus into whether it can survive or whether the species can find its ancient origin and live through the Earth's sixth great extinction. So my answer is this. Let evolution, the primal forces of nature, decide our fate in all of its fair dreadfulness. It is not for us to fret over, but rather to endure, relearn, adapt, and evolve individually in however bizarre manner we humans will devise. So focus on your own personal strategy, and may the odds be ever in your favor, for certainly they are not. My climate change update for this week includes a paper from the September 25th issue of Nature Communications demonstrating that, based on data from five glacial cycles, ice sheets melt for centuries once they begin the process. A subsequent paper published in the October 10th issue of Environmental Research Letters indicates all previous work on the topic of sea level rise has been conservative. Color me shocked. And the planet's air conditioner is breaking down even more rapidly than scientists previously imagined. Ice loss in the Arctic has contributed to rapidly accelerating temperatures in the far north, according to a paper published this week in the Open Atmospheric Science Journal. The paper reports that a 7 degrees centigrade temperature rise for October between 1979 and 2012 in Barrow, Alaska, resulted directly from loss of sea ice. The lead author of the study, a professor emeritus from the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, said he was, quote, astonished. He went on to say, quote, I think I have never anywhere seen such a large increase in temperature over such a short period, end quote. And there's still some ice in the Arctic. We can only imagine the rapidity of change when it's all gone, and it won't be long. That about wraps it up this week. Please tune in next week as we turn the show over to guest host Pauline Schneider. Ms. Schneider will be interviewing activists in Westchester County, New York. Be sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. Feel free to post questions you'd like us to address on the show. And please continue to follow my blog, GuyMcPherson.com, for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. I'm hosted by Kevin Hester in New Zealand for the next 10 days or so. Mid to late November finds me in Ashland, Oregon, along with Chico in San Francisco, California, the latter for the Earth at Risk conference. You can keep abreast of these and future speaking tours on my blog and also on Facebook. Finally, if you're finding yourself in need of support in dealing with these weighty issues, please find the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group page on Facebook and join the conversation. You'll find people going through a similar emotional roller coaster who can help provide some personal insight into these monumental issues. A few days ago in that group, Jamie Hecht was responding to an article at Mother Jones titled, "Pentagon, We Could Soon Be Fighting Climate Wars." Hecht wrote, "I guess those granola-crunching lefties over at the Pentagon are in on the great climate hoax. How do deniers handle this?" It's an excellent point, well made and few enough characters to fit within a tweet. How do deniers of anthropogenic climate change, most of whom strongly support the U.S. military, deal with the military admitting climate change is caused by humans? Ah, the predicament. I'll see you on the radio next Tuesday evening. No, check that. I'll see you on the radio in 2 weeks. Pauline Schneider is taking over next week. If you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives at prn.fm and rate us on iTunes. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end, nature bats last. Thanks again to all the excellent contributions this week and to Afrozen and Rianne Farrigan for the music.
Really good. She bats last and she's coming.